Today's Tei Show is on Case 19 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 19 is entitled Gute's One Finger. Engo's Introduction. Even when one particle stirs, the whole universe is involved. A blossom opens and the world responds. But what do you see when no particle stirs and a blossom does not open? It is said that it is like cutting the thread on a reel. You cut one and you cut all, or it is like dyeing the thread on a reel. Dye it once and you dye it all. Now, if you eradicate all the complications that affect you and bring out the treasure within you, you will find that everything is all right, above and below, before and behind. If you have not done so yet, see the following. Gute, whenever he was asked a question, only raised a finger. Secho's verse, well now, I like Gute's way of answering. Who could compare with him throughout the whole universe? He let down the wooden float into the dark sea, making the blind turtle swim, sink, and swim and cling to it. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen tonight, this morning. This is a koan. There's several versions of this koan. I've spoken about the version that's in the Mumonkan, but this is a little different version. It leaves out some of the story, but basically, this is about Master Gute. When anybody would ask him a question, he would always just raise his finger and say nothing. But Gute's one finger became very famous in Song Dynasty China. People would come to see him sometimes in great emotional distress. They would come and say, Gute, you know, my father is dying. And Gute would raise his finger, and people would automatically become calm. Their tears would stop. Or somebody would say, Gute, I've lost my job. I don't know what I'm going to do. And Gute would raise his finger, and people would look at his finger, and they'd suddenly become calm. So hopefully, if you continue to practice Zen, we'll have a chance to work on the one-finger koan. But today, it would be a good idea if I said a little bit about it. When we're little kids, we definitely learn from other people. We even learn how to be human. You know, I saw a couple years ago, I was watching this film on child development. And it was really interesting because these two parents had a baby. The father, I think, was carrying the baby in one of those papoose-type baby carriers that basically the baby's faced outward, and it was draped over the father's shoulders, and the man and wife were going to an ice cream truck, and they ordered two ice creams, and ice cream cones, actually. And so, you know, they paid for the cones, and the cones, they started to eat the cones, and the baby just started sobbing inconsolably. And mother offered the baby a taste of her cone, and the baby kept sobbing. And the child psychologist said what they should have done was ordered a cone for the baby, I'm not a child psychologist, so I don't know if that was good advice or not, but the film basically said that, you know, the baby wanted to be part of it all. You know, and by the way, if you have a child and you didn't buy your child an ice cream cone, I hope you're not feeling guilty right now. It's okay. The child turned out okay. But the point the psychologist was making is that even little children want to be part of it all. You know, obviously the baby couldn't have even held an ice cream cone, but the baby wanted to have an ice cream cone. It wanted to be like mom and dad. It wanted to be part of it. And you know, I think that's something so basic about human beings is that we're imitative animals. You know, we imitate in order to be part of it all. And this is how we become human beings. They say there's a wonderful child psychologist named Stern, who's no longer alive, but he was one of the first people to film babies' interactions with their mothers, and he noticed that babies are actually very, very focused on their mother's attention. And maybe that seems obvious, but when the mother approaches the baby looks right at the mother's eyes. And if the mother's eyes look into the baby's eyes, there's like this magical liveliness, right? And the baby and the mother are sort of like sort of locked in each other's gaze, and it's very, very exciting for the baby. The baby smiles and burbles, and basically the psychologist was saying that the baby becomes real for itself through the eyes of the mother. And then psychologist also filmed a mother who came in and looked at the baby or didn't look at the baby, and the baby's eyes are like searching for the mother's attention, searching for the mother's gaze, and the mother doesn't give it, and you can see the baby's face like darken, right? And it's like emotional distress. Yeah, so it is wonderful, even now, you know, when I see somebody I care about and they turn and they look at you and return your gaze, it's like heaven, right? It's just like so wonderful. If you see a friend and you walk over and the person looks you right in the eye and you look them right in the eye, there's a kind of energy that's so beautiful, right? It's really beautiful. It's wonderful to participate in that kind of beautiful energy. A friend of mine is a psychotherapist, and she was saying that sometimes she can tell in a minute, sometimes when she works with couples, where they are, because she said so many of the couples she works with don't look each other in the eye. You know, and as soon as she sees that, she can tell a lot about their relationship. You know, they're maybe afraid to look each other in the eye because they're afraid to look because they don't think they'll be seen. You know, and that's very, I find that very moving. You know, that people have this deep desire to be seen, and to have that reciprocated. And when it happens, it's just out of this world. You know, it's just so wonderful. So there's something really wonderful and something we should never look down on about being seen by other people, you know. But on the other hand, sometimes that can be a little bit of a problem too. You know, so I'm sure everybody in this room has had anxieties when you were around 12 or 13 about whether you would be part of the group or not. you know. I was just listening on the radio to another child psychologist who was talking about how stressful it is to be in intermediate school in the United States. Apparently, this person was saying that like elementary school is basically a pretty good experience for people. You know, they're learning things, and the kids are, you know, pretty, their stage of their developmental stage doesn't make them too concerned about what other people think of them, and they're not too critical of other people. But apparently, when you get into like the 7th grade, 8th grade, there's this huge amount of like mutual judging that goes on. And a lot of kids suffer intensely from this. You know, apparently the internet and Snapchat and other Instagram have made this even worse, because the psychologist was saying if you, in the old days, if you had to rush out of the house and if you were a young woman and you didn't do anything with your hair and it didn't look very good, you went to class and you came home and it was okay. You could recover. Your reputation could recover. Or, you know, if you were a young man and you were like me when I was 12 years old and you had a lot of blemishes, you know, it was okay, you know, you had your good days and your bad days. And you just sort of hoped nobody looked too closely on your bad days. But they said now what happens is people take your picture and circulate it. And they'll make you know, snide remarks about your appearance. So they said people, you know, these kids are really like terrified of being judged. It sounds terrible. I'm so glad this didn't exist when I was a teenager, because I would have been so easy to make fun of, you know. It's really difficult under those circumstances for people to get free. You know, they get trapped in this labyrinth of judgments, you know. And you know, basically, everybody is afraid of basically being seen. And at the same time, everybody's eagerly trying to be noticed. You know, this is like a major life stage for most American kids today. And I don't know that it ever really stops. You know, when we exit intermediate school, we go on to high school. You know, I don't know about your high school, but I went to a public high school where there were people definitely sorted themselves out in a kind of class system, you know. So there were definitely people in my high school who were like the beautiful people. They were the sort of the prom king and the prom queen. We actually had a prom in my high school, and we had a prom king and a prom queen. And we had people who were sort of like the popular people. I myself was not in that group, you know, since I was a nerd, right? There wasn't really a nerd group, right? So I was just sort of off to myself. But there were definitely, like, there was like a hierarchy. And there were definitely people I knew who were very concerned about how they looked and how they were regarded within the high school community, you know, where I went to school. I remember seeing this wonderful movie. I don't know if you know the comedian Albert Brooks, but he was in this movie. He's a movie producer. He's in the movie business, and of course, the movie world is all about being seen and being envied, right? And in this one scene, he's at a party, and he's. He can't look at anybody because he's watching how other people are noticing him. So he can't even finish a conversation because he's already looking around the room to see who's noticing him. I have to say that, you know, I've been at academic conferences that are kind of like this too, where, you know, somebody might be starting to talk to me and then somebody very important comes in the room and they'll just sort of drift off and go get noticed by that person. So sort of what happens in our early social life, I think maybe around the seventh grade, in a way, it doesn't stop, you know. I do think that the media have made it, new electronic media have made it worse. You probably are aware that the more time you spend on Facebook, the more likely you are to be depressed. And Facebook, I've just discovered, is old, is for old people. That's what I just read. That people under 30 don't really use Facebook that much, which stuns me, because I thought all the world used Facebook. But it turns out I asked my students in class, I teach freshmen, and I asked one in one of my classes, I said, how many of you use Facebook? And they looked at me like, you know, that was like asking, how many of you drive a Studebaker or drive a... for those of you who don't know, that's an old car that went out of business long ago. How many of you use Facebook? And it was like, Facebook? Oh, I think my parents use that. It's like, oh, wow. I thought that was really cool, but I guess not. So, but people on Facebook want to project a certain image. And I definitely have Facebook friends, and you know, basically every time they're on Facebook, they're projecting an image of themselves, you know, having a lot of fun, surrounded by friends, and they said that this actually has an effect on people. People see that and think, oh my God, that person's so happy and popular, and I'm alone in my room going through Facebook, right? You know? So, but this is like the downside of that beautiful potential we have to connect with other people that we develop that makes us human, right? You know, being seen and by seeing and being seen, and that sort of like harmony or synchrony, like synchrony. It's like music in synchrony. That's so beautiful. But, you know, as we get older, it's turned into something else. It can have a kind of desperate quality. We become like that little baby whose mother doesn't look at him, right? And and our face is dark and we feel left out, you know. So we spend a lot of our time searching for the thing that will get us noticed. And in a way, this becomes a really huge problem. In fact, maybe it's the biggest problem we have. You know, we have a sitting group up in North Jersey, up in Stanhope, which is a little bit north of Route 80, every Sunday morning. And after we sit, we all go have coffee, and we have a standing agreement that we will not talk about Trump. And yet, you know, usually, like around 40 minutes in, somebody will mention something that somehow leads to Trump. It's 7 degrees of Trump. You might not know that either, but at any rate, sooner or later, somebody mentions the one who cannot be named, and then we all look at our watches to see how long we were able to avoid talking about Trump. So. I'm about halfway through the Tay Show, and I'm going to talk about Trump. But it's pretty clear that Mr. Trump is actually a really good case of this. You know, he is very clearly hungry for approval. And he's so hungry for approval that he doesn't pay much attention to people, you know. That seems like a contradiction, but he's so caught up in his inner drama of needing to be approved of that he is quite indifferent to other people's feelings and reactions. You know, I think it's really accurate to say that he goes through his day, you know, basically trying to figure out how he can be noticed by the people he cares about and how he can get that approving look, right? But he's not alone. You know, lots of people are like that. And maybe we're all a little like Trump to some degree. Maybe it's possible that all of us have some qualities like that. I think if we're honest about ourselves, and it's because they're basically good motives that get twisted. You know, it's part of being human to want to be seen and want to be approved of. But you know, Trump is like obsessively concerned about this, so much so that he can't really notice other people. So he's really a prisoner of this sort of dynamic. I mean, there have been a million articles psychoanalyzing Trump on the internet. And one was a psychiatrist said it's very clear that Trump, you know, had an abusive father who didn't give withhold affection, you know, basically, and withhold attention until Trump conformed to the father's expectations. And probably physically abusive also father, too. So it explains a lot, really. I mean, it doesn't excuse everything, but it definitely explains a lot. You know, so I think we can all get a little bit caught in this. And that becomes, you know, sort of our struggle, you know, we all need, I think, to put aside that craving to be seen and to be admired by other people. And it's difficult to do that because, you know, if we haven't developed, like you could say, the resources, the personal resources, that's almost impossible to do. You know, so it's you know, one way to think about Zazen is that we're developing those personal resources. You know, when you do Zazen, you sit down on a cushion and you watch your breath and you close your eyes. And even though it helps enormously to practice with other people, you know, practicing with other people is kind of a strange enterprise, right? Because we're alone together. You know, that's a wonderful way to put it. You know, we're alone together. So if anybody asks you where you're going on a Saturday morning, you're saying, I'm going to go and be alone with other people. But that's really what we're doing. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath. And, you know, if you're really concentrating, it's definitely the case that you stop paying attention to the people around you. You know, you just become quite absorbed in, hopefully, your breath and maybe the struggle to get away from your thoughts. And possibly you have some physical discomfort that you're wrestling with, too. But the world around you recedes. And in a way, you're sort of like alone with your breath or alone with your thoughts, or you're alone with your awareness, right? And this is something actually that people fear, you know, I would say. You know, when people do meditation, they think it's trivial. It's just like, well, I'm just going to sit down and watch my breath, and they don't realize psychologically what it means to do that, to be alone. You know, to stop seeking the attention of others and just be alone with your breath, with your thoughts, with your body. And it's really kind of like a radical aloneness if you think about what meditation entails. In fact, years ago there was a op-ed piece in the New York Times by some woman who actually said, you know, she interpreted this behavior, she was critical of meditation, and she said, this is very narcissistic. We're all sitting down on the cushion and going into ourselves. And she said, this is what could be more, you know, narcissistic. But actually, it's not narcissistic. See, I mean, I think it's narcissism is and I'm not an expert, but I would say narcissism is rooted in that desperate hunger to be seen and approved by others. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we're really alone, that's I don't think that's a narcissistic impulse. On the contrary, you know, and it's interesting, you know, if you, I hope everybody in this room at some point will come to Sesshin. You know, and it's such a transformation because, you know, on day one of Sesshin, you know, people are just getting into the process. And I can remember when I first started doing Zen 40 years ago, you know, I'd go to Sesshin and, you know, the first day I was, you know, I would make sure my, you know, my shirt looked right and I would wash my face and I would make sure my hair looked okay. And you know, but by around day three, it's like you just don't care. And it's not like you're so beaten down you can't pay attention to your appearance. It's that that suddenly seems so irrelevant. You know, how you're projecting is so irrelevant. And you know, at Sesshin we have this rule that people are really not supposed to look at each other. You know, and it seems antisocial, but it's not, you know. The idea is that you need to create an environment at Sesshin where people aren't constantly monitoring their own behavior with one eye towards other people. You know, so we're always sort of, more than we realize, we're always sort of tailoring what we do to win the approval or at least shield ourselves from the disapproval of others. You know, so you know, I have a job where I supervise people, right? And you know, I'll come around a corner in my building, and there'll be a couple teachers who work in the writing program, and they're just leaning against a wall and they're talking, and they see me, and they all sort of straighten up, you know, like it's the military, like they're going to salute me or something, and they sort of quiet down, like they don't want me to hear, you know, like maybe they're saying what a jerk I am. I don't know. But I don't think that's true. I just think it's instinctual, right? It's like, uh-oh, the boss or, you know, the father is here, you know? And people sort of try to, they straighten up. It's like they don't want to project a slovenly image or something, you know? And I'll, how's it going, guys? And I, you know, try to put them at ease and move on down the hall. But it's definitely the case that people lock into my presence, you know, in this context because I'm the boss, their boss, and I've done that myself, you know. You know, when the dean comes in, I definitely straighten up and you know, try to look like I care. Some, you know. So you know, we all do this, but it can be imprisoning, right? And so it's a sheen. It's so, we just say, don't even, you know, when you walk by people, don't try to catch their gaze. You know, don't try to be noticed and give them a little smile. And because when you do that, then you start wondering, oh, how does my hair look? And I wonder if this shirt is okay and stuff. And then you're back in that place. So there's something so good about not having to worry about the approval of others. See, you know, there's a famous Zen story about Bodhidharma. Just to get off the track just a little bit, the Bodhidharma was the Indian monk who brought Zen to China, and he had an interview with the Emperor of China, but it didn't go well, and Bodhidharma left the Emperor's court and lived up in a cave for 9 years, and finally a student showed up, and Bodhidharma wasn't sure he wanted to take this guy on as a student. He wasn't sure the student was ready to be his student. So he wouldn't let the guy come into his cave. And finally, to show his devotion, this is a myth, not what really happened. The seeker cut his arm off and handed it to Bodhidharma to show how serious he was. This is a myth. Do not do this, right? But Bodhidharma said, you didn't have to cut your arm off. I'm just looking for somebody who doesn't seek the approval of others. See? So Bodhidharma, he was basically saying, look, I didn't let you in because I wanted to see how you would react to rejection. You know, you didn't have to cut your arm off. I just wanted to see you wouldn't be, your motivation was coming from a different place. Your motivation wasn't coming from the desire for approval. It was coming from a place in yourself, see. It's often the case that when we look at our motivations, they're not coming from ourselves. You know, they're coming from that desperate search to see and be seen. You know, so many things in life we do. You know, I have a number of friends who have changed careers, and their first career was the career their parents wanted them to adopt. And they were often successful at this, but unhappy, you know. And especially in, you know, when you're in your 40s, you know, people sometimes change careers because they realize, you know, this is what my mom and dad wanted me to do. Now, what do I want to do? And it's a very different relationship to your work when it's coming from that place, you know. But it won't happen if you aren't cultivating certain, you could say, capacity in yourself. And that capacity can be cultivated, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you're alone with yourself and your breath. And, you know, and everybody sort of disappears. You're no longer, it's like, I don't really care right now what anybody is thinking. I'm just following the breath out. I'm just following the breath out. And this is really, in itself, a challenging situation, and it's one of the reasons it's so hard to practice on your own. You know, people will come here, be enthusiastic, and then, you know, they might not practice, and they'll maybe get a cushion and put it in their house, and they'll come back and say, you know, I bought the cushion, but I just don't sit. It's the darndest thing. You know, and they treat it as though this is trivial, but it's not trivial. Sitting down on the cushion and being alone in this very radical way, you know, it makes people uncomfortable sometimes. You know, my father was definitely somebody who was very uncomfortable being alone with himself. You know, he worked very hard never to be alone. When my father died, he had lots of friends who said, you know, your father was such a warm person. And he was a warm person. He had many wonderful traits. But, you know, I know from being around him for, you know, 40 years, that he was terrified of being alone. You know, and when he was alone with himself, I think there were lots of issues that would start bubbling up that he just could not deal with, you know. And I think that's quite common, you know, actually. He would make himself busy all the time. He'd get busy doing things rather than tolerate that kind of isolation, that kind of aloneness. But, you know, when you are alone, you know, and you begin to watch the breath, you know, you start to go through, you could say, like the layers of your mind, right? It's like you've turned off that craving for approval, and you start, you know, one of the things that must have bothered my father is he had a lot of issues that he hadn't worked out, you know. My father, like any human being, had all kinds of, he felt like a failure in a lot of ways, he felt unlovable in a lot of ways, and very anxious persons, kind of, you know, and when he would be with himself, I think all that stuff came up right away, and his reaction was to try to go find somebody somebody who would reciprocate to him in a friendly way, and then he wouldn't have to deal with those feelings, you know. And he craved that kind of attention because it rescued him from all this stuff he hadn't really worked through. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we're watching the breath, you know, this stuff can come up. You know, some of our sits are just great. You sit down on the cushion, You're watching the breath, you get into samadhi, it's very blissful, it's very beautiful, that's wonderful. And then the bell rings and that's great. But there are some sits where all this stuff comes up, right? And this is these sits are actually essential to making progress along the path, right? You know, so you sit down on the cushion and you suddenly realize that you didn't get the promotion and all these feelings about, you know, not being smart enough or not being good enough, and then, you know, that all comes out. And, you know, if you keep practicing Zen, you know, you ground yourself in a kind of, it's like if you think about the way, the Zen way of thinking about the mind is that, you know, at the core of the mind, there's this luminous, compassionate calm. You could put it that way, right? Like, at the core of your mind, there's this, we say Buddha nature. There's this enlightened awareness at the core of your mind. It's absolutely imperturbable. It's boundlessly generous. It's totally confident, right? You know, but, you know, covering that up are all these other, these layers of personal experience, all these we say karma, you know, all this karma. You know, so it's a it's sort of like clouding this, blocking access to this, right? You know, so what happens in Zen is, you know, you sit down on the cushion, you're watching the breath, you want to have a blissful sit, and when you have a blissful sit, it's like you're getting access right away to that deep, luminous, compassionate Buddha nature. That happens sometimes. You come in, you sit down on the cushion, you enter this deep, beautiful sit, you know, and you're just there in this wonderful, loving, serene state. It's like, boom, right there, right in Buddha nature. But sometimes you have sits where you come in and you don't get there. You encounter all the karma, right, on the way there, and you maybe never get there during the sit. It's like the whole time you're reliving your sense of worthlessness because something at work happened a certain way, or you're reliving your experience of rejection, you know, or something. You know, this is all human. And so, you know, if you haven't done enough practice, this could really throw you. You know, this can really be, you know, it's enough to make people get off the cushion and not come back. You know, when there was a guy who came here. And I overheard him one day say, he was behind the partition there where everybody gets dressed, and I overheard him say, he didn't know I was on the other side. And I wasn't eavesdropping, I just heard it, right? But what happened was, I heard him say to somebody who was new, the guy said, "Wow, this is wonderful, I had a great sit," and this other person said, "Yeah, it's like that at first, but then all the problems come back." That's what he actually said. And I was going to rush around the screen and go, "No, it's not like that," but I just thought, "Oh, forget it, you know, the guy will figure it out or not, you know." But of course the problems come back. You know, they're not resolved, right? But now you have a tool to work them through, right? You have a tool. Sometimes you sit down on the cushion, you get to this place, this Buddha nature, which is luminous, compassionate, and this is you. This is who you really are. That's the Buddhist teaching. And you know, when you get to that place, you feel like you can handle anything. You know, sometimes that you'll get a sit like that. You're like, I can do anything. You know, but sometimes you have sits where you just don't get there because all this stuff is coming. But, you know, if you've gotten there a couple times, you begin to develop confidence in the process. You realize, right now I'm in this place, but I know there's this other place I can get to. Right? And avoidance isn't the way. The way is to, we say, you know, you can say working through. You sit with your sense of disappointment. Or you sit with your sense of grief. You know? Grief. You know, sometimes we have grief. You know, something didn't work out. You know, it's like, oh, you know. And my brother died when he was 50. You know, I'm not over that. You know, I mean, it's done, but I definitely feel sad about it. And sometimes I'll have a sit where I miss my brother. You know, I wouldn't be a human being if I didn't do that. And I have a sense of loss, and I sit with my loss, you know, and I sit with my sense of disappointment. You know, I thought we were going to be old geezers together, you know, and go hiking or something, you know. So, you know, but then, you know, it doesn't overwhelm you because you know you have this other thing there. And after a while, you sit with your grief or you sit with your sadness, and everything begins to clear up. And you get to that place, that luminous, imperturbable, loving place, which is your true nature. You know, and then, you know, you realize, I handled that. I can handle that. You know, I can handle anything, really. You know, that's worth so much. To have that, you get a kind of resilience, right? Resilience. Because you know, no, I can work this through. I can get back to that place that you have a, like there's a grounding that you can count on. And you know, one of the things that happens in koans is, you know, koans definitely stir up a lot of mud. You know, if somebody gives you a koan, you're working with this koan, you think it's funny, and then you suddenly realize, you suddenly encounter these negative feelings in yourself. You know, and people do get thrown by this. They think, I'll never work this through, I'll never get out of this. You know, and then just naturally you return to that beautiful, luminous Buddha nature. You work it through. And if you do that 100 times, you're a different person. It doesn't mean you're infallible or flawless or that you have no karma left. But it means I know how to clean up my karma. I know how to work through my obstacles. You know, and big obstacles take more work and little obstacles take a little work. But you develop great confidence in the process. See, I can do this. I've been through this a million times before, and I always get back to my luminous Buddha nature. See? So, you know, the problem is that people don't always, you know, they take the wrong path. They think the solution is to avoid, like my dad, you know, my father. He thought the solution to his anxiety, his neurosis, right? Well, like all humans who are mentally healthy are actually neurotic too, right? So all people build up defenses to help them cope, you know, and then they also have these injuries they've closed up inside themselves. And, you know, my father's strategy was not to do this, you know. It was to seek out others who would say, oh, Larry, you're such a great guy. You know, and then he would feel like, ah, I'm not a failure, I'm not a bad son, I'm not a terrible husband, I'm a great guy, you know. But that's really not a good solution, because you don't develop the resilience, you know. My father had a drinking problem, and he had a drinking problem because his strategy didn't work, right? It didn't work for him. He kept repeating it, you know. And by the way, In Buddhism, there's this word samsara. Samsara. Samsara means repeating. You know, you're repeating the same behavior, but it's not getting you to Buddha nature. See? So, you know, people spend a lot of time in Zen, we would say, running from themselves. And we mean running from their Buddha nature. You know, instead of working these problems through and encountering their Buddha nature, they keep looking outside. Looking to others to solve their problem. You see, looking for the approval of others. And this is paralyzing in so many different ways. I mean, one of the things that it does is it makes us less resilient and flexible, but also less creative. It's very hard to be creative when you're racked with self-doubt, right? I mean, you know, yesterday, one of my favorite poets died, W.S. Merwin. You know, he's not everybody's favorite poet, but he was 91 years old. He had a great life. He died in Hawaii, where he's been living for the last 30 years. He's won every literary award in the world. But I remember reading an interview with Merwin, and Merwin basically said, I don't write my poems. You know, he basically said, I don't write my poems. You know, I just trust, he basically said, I trust the process. And by the way, Merlin was a big Zen. He studied with Aitken Roshi in Hawaii. That's why he lived in Hawaii. He said, I trust the process. You know, see, you sit down on the at your desk and you start writing a poem, you know, you really don't know what's going to come out. And if you say to yourself, I must write a great poem today, that's like the worst thing you can do. And you just have to let whatever is coming out come out. And if you're also worried about what readers will think of your work, you know, that's poison or that's terrible. You know, what would so-and-so say about what I just wrote? You know, that's so destructive. You know, Jackson Pollock, the great painter, you know, he was in an unhealthy relationship with these critics who would write about his work and approvingly. And then when he tried to leave that kind of work and do new work, they all wrote disapprovingly. And he developed a drinking problem, and he actually died in a car crash when he was drunk, because he was unwilling to put them aside and look into himself, right? And go, and he didn't have confidence in the process. One more example, you know, one of my favorite composers is Aaron Copland, and I remember reading an interview with Aaron Copland, and Aaron Copland said, you know, I definitely don't write my music. He said, I don't know where it comes from, but I don't write it. See, and I think that's somebody who's gained deep access to his Buddha nature. You know, that's somebody who doesn't look to others for approval. You know, that's real freedom. That's real freedom. Trusting, you would say trusting yourself, but it's, I think it's bigger than the little self, trusting your true nature. Even when one particle stirs, the whole universe is involved. A blossom opens and the world responds. But what do you see when no particle stirs and the blossom doesn't open, when your gaze is not met by the universe? It is said that it is like cutting the thread on a reel, one cut and you cut it all, or it is like dyeing the thread on a reel, dye it once and you dye it all. Now, if you eradicate all the complications that affect you and bring out the treasure within you, you can find your true nature. You will find that everything is all right, above and below, before and behind. If you have not done so yet, see the following. Main subject, Goethe, whenever he was asked a question, only raised a finger. See, it's that luminous intelligence, that compassionate awareness is always there, always there. And, you know, Zen is a process of doubting that and finding it, doubting it and finding it, doubting it and finding it, till you have this calm. You trust. It's always there. Goethe, whenever he was asked a question, only raised a finger. Secho's verse, well now, I like Goethe's way of answering. Who could compare with him throughout the whole universe? He's got it. He let down the wooden float into the dark sea, making the blind turtle sink and swim and cling to it. He rescues people with his luminous Buddha nature.